Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. They don't make them quite like Rob Smith anymore. Rob is a native Southerner and true outdoorsman who's been obsessed with fishing for almost 60 years. I'd heard of Rob, aka The Mustache, through various mutual acquaintances, but only after an introduction from one of our members, thank you, Palmer, was I able to finally invite Rob to be on the show. In this episode of Anchored, Rob shares how he went from game warden to landscaper to fishing guide, and we cover stripers, muskie, trout, and more.
I was born here in Atlanta and not necessarily raised here. I was, we moved to Memphis when my dad was in the medical school, and then we moved to Augusta when he was doing his internship. And that's where we did that episode of Das Boot in Augusta. And then we moved to Denver for 2 years of Army for him, and then back to Atlanta in 1970, which took me a half a day to find the Chattahoochee River about a mile from our house.
Didn't take long. How did you find it? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I walked out our backyard and walked straight downhill to the creek, followed that creek to the next creek, and two more creeks, I found the river. And that's me. I was just going to where the big water was. So,
do you mind if Go ahead. I've got to get used to the southern way of speech, because if I recall, everything just slows down just a little bit. I'll settle into your cadence. Don't worry.
Yeah.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
62.
Okay. Do you remember how long ago it was when you ventured down to the river?
1970.
So you would have been, that's my polite way of getting you to tell me how old you were.
Yeah, 11.
11. Okay. Did you fish before then?
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
What's the story there?
My dad loved to trout fish, and my grandfather just loved to fish for everything. And he provided everything for me to fish because he loved it, that I just really liked it. And so I took it from there with a lot of gusto. it was a lot of problems because it was more important to me than school was. Very much so.
So were you fishing, if you started in Georgia, you're fishing for trout?
No, not at first. Where we fished on the Savannah River and the Das Boot, we probably fished there once or twice a week when I was growing up in Augusta. So, you know, I was anywhere from 5 to 8 or maybe 4 to 8. And we had a boat and went fishing quite often on the Savannah River. So actually when we did the show, it had been 50 years since I'd actually fished the part of that river. And so it was really exciting for me to get back on there 50 years later.
That's a big river.
It was great. Yeah. And it's fun. A lot of stuff to do. I do a lot of shad fishing there now with even trying to learn how to spay.
Oh, good for
I'm
you.
Not good.
You'll get there. Well, when
did sooner or later?
When did fly fishing enter the mix? When you went to Colorado?
No, it was probably when I was about 5 or 6. We had a farm pond. My grandfather did, and he was the gentleman farmer. He was an attorney, but he was the gentleman farmer that had his southern farm pond. And so I go out there and catch bluegill and bass on the fly rod. My dad was that one that got me going on that. And I've been hooked on it ever since. You know, it was brim and bass forever. And then I started stepping out and got into stripers and, you know, everything. Trout when we were in Colorado and trout when we moved back here. The river here in town is one of the southernmost trout fisheries in the country.
Mm-hmm. But fly fishing for bass and other panfish and just various species 50 or 60 years ago, that's early. How did your dad get into it?
We had my grandmother's brother, who was a doctor in the small town that they grew up in. He would take every Thursday off of every week and go trout fishing in trout season or brim or bass fishing in the rest of the year. So he would take my dad when my dad was young, and that's how my dad got started. So, you know, it came to me, honestly. And I took it to a completely different level than they would ever know.
Were they regretting their decision to take you out when you started skipping school? Because I'm assuming you probably started missing school by accident.
Yeah, it was a lot of being grounded. I was grounded for like a week at a time. I get off, get in trouble for fishing again, and be grounded for another week. So, and it didn't take long, usually a day or two.
Did you have anyone you really looked up to back then? Like, was the fishing industry a thing? Were there any sportsmen you really admired?
You know, I had every magazine. And back then, I'm talking Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, Sports Afield. Those were the top three. And they were really strong back then in the 60s. There was one or two local ones, but, you know, if you wanted to see anything trout fishing or fly fishing, you had to go to one of the top three. And, you know, you had Lee Wolf and, you know, Kurt Gowdy would be on some of them, but it was right at the start. If you fly fished, you probably only trout fished back then. You know, and occasionally somebody would write something about bluegill or bass or something, but mainly trout. It's all you saw.
Mm-hmm.
It's way different now.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get there. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on what it's like now. I've got 10 million things to talk to you about, so I hope you're ready for some rapid fire here in the next little bit.
Let's go.
But let's keep going on this timeline. So obviously, by the time you're a teenager, it's officially going to be in your life forever. Were you starting to think about what you wanted to do with yourself when you were out of school and off into manhood?
That one's always been a very tough one because, you know, my family was very professionally oriented, attorneys and doctors and all that. And I knew that that was not for me. I could not see the light at the end of the tunnel to sit down and study that hard. And I just couldn't go more than a couple days without fishing or hunting or something like that. So I ended up going completely different. And I worked for the state for a couple of years in wildlife management. Didn't enjoy that as much as I thought, and I got transferred to some areas I didn't like at all and got out of that and went into landscaping, which, you know, I got that honest too because my dad was one of the founding members of the botanical gardens here. And so I love plants and growing and all of it. And so I did that for a little over 20 years. And then in the last few years, I'd not taken a vacation. And I owned my own business by then. And I took a two-week vacation on a hunting trip in Wisconsin. And when I came home, I was driving to work and just got all just freaked out and decided that I'm done. And I went to work in a fishing store. I sold everything I had, landscaping, my whole business in 1 week, and went to work in a fishing store.
Wait. I have questions. Okay. So were you a game warden?
Yes.
What about that job in particular did you not like? Because a lot of us think, well, that's probably what we should do. We want to be outside all the time. But was there something in particular that you really didn't like about it?
No, it wasn't the job. It was some of the people that I worked with that was difficult. The job was probably the best job that I've ever had as far as enjoyment and most of the people I worked for. But I was transferred to an area where the guy that was in charge of that area, he and I did not click. And, you know, I was young in my 20s, and I said, bye-bye. And that was probably my greatest regret ever. But, you know, when you're 24 or so, you know, what do you know?
Yeah, no, I understand. I hear you. I've lost some sleep on some of those nights. Just why would I say that? What do you regret? Do you regret walking away? Do you regret the way you left?
I regret walking away. I would be retired completely now with, you know, with the full pension and all that. But it's probably good that I didn't, because I am very happy with where I am now with, you know, the whole fly fishing industry and being able to be a part of such things as this. It never would have happened if I'd have stayed working for the state. So, you know.
And life has gotten so political and it's so different now with social media. I would imagine it's a totally different world than it used to be.
Extremely. And I'm not a social media person.
No, I see that.
I learned a long time ago that if you tell everybody stuff, you know, and I work in the fly shop here now. And if I tell everybody all the information they want to hear, that all I'm going to do is see them down there. And, you know, so it ruins my fishing. It ruins the fishing for, I was guiding a lot for until just recently, and it ruins the fishing for all my customers. And so I was very protective about where I fished. And, you know, I wouldn't even just take anybody. I had to know who they were and know that they didn't have a boat and really didn't think that they were qualified to have a boat. So then I would take them.
Right.
So, yeah.
No, I understand. What about the landscaping thing? What about it was your real wake up moment? Because it sounds like it was something pretty sudden.
I think that after about 5 or 6 years of no vacation and, you know, and I knew that I probably wouldn't, I was just worked to death, and I came home and was completely relaxed for the first time in a long time. And then I got in my truck and started to go to work, and it was just, I was anxious, you know, and I was like, you know, there has to be something better than this, to where, you know, I can enjoy my life, do what I want to do, do what I enjoy doing. And I think it was a good choice, you know, monetarily, probably not, you know, but you know, everything's not money. It's enjoying life. And you know, my dad loved trout fish. He bought 4 acres on the river here so that we could all trout fish, walk out the back door and go trout fishing. And he never used it that much. We had to force him because of work. He was always busy. And then he passed at a very early age and really didn't get to enjoy it like he thought he would. And, you know, I decided a long time ago that was never going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, any one of us could drop the next day and you don't know. So I try to do everything I can.
Mm-hmm. That all makes sense. So then what was it like transitioning from having your own business and being on the go 7 days a week to getting into into fishing? What was the first step that you took?
One of my friends owned a fishing store, and he wanted it to be a fly fishing store, but it wasn't. And he always needed help, and I was already kind of part-time helping just whenever he needed somebody on the weekends. And, you know, hoping for a discount, you know, that's what that was.
Yep.
And, you know, when I asked him, he said, I really would love for you to come on and, you know, cause I always work. And, so we did okay with that. And then he was not a good manager. And so he ended up going out of business. And at that point, I went to work at the Fish Hawk in Atlanta. And, you know, in many ways, that's probably the best thing that's ever happened to me, because we're one of the biggest retail stores in the country. You know, sell a lot of rods. And, you know, we have a huge customer base right here. And everybody in the Southeast knows us. And, you know, I dare to say that most places you go, if you mention the Fish Hawk, somebody's going to know something about it. So, you know, and it's been in business for almost 50 years now.
Oh, wow. When did you go there? Do you remember what year that was?
2005, I think.
Okay. Wow. We're in 2022. So quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And so are you the manager there now?
No.
What do you do? I mean, I know you guide, and we'll get there. I guess that's my next question is, when did you start guiding? Were you working at the shop first?
No, I was guiding long before that. When I was still in landscaping, I was guiding trout fishing. And, you know, somewhere in the mid-90s, I started fly fishing for stripers in one of the reservoirs here where Henry Cowan does it on Lake Lanier. And then I started, you know, fishing in some of the rivers around here that had stripers. And I learned how to do that and learned how to, I did it pretty well. And that's when I started transitioning from trout guiding to striper guiding. And, you know, did that for many, many years. And now the whole fishery is on the downside. So I've really backed off from that, and I may not guide anymore at all.
Okay. You know, it's not that you can't get clients. Is it that you feel that, is it an ethical thing?
Yeah, I could get clients. If I stopped work, I could probably guide for, you know, the entire summer from April till October. Almost every day, if weather allowing. It's not that. It's the fishery is really bad. And, you know, for many, many years, you know, it wasn't catching one or two fish. It was catching 10 or 15 fish or more. And now it's gone. And, you know, if I go out there, I'm hoping to catch one or maybe two. And if it's really good, three. But, you know, I just can't promise that to anybody. And I know no guy can, but, you know, I almost could. And, you know, I just don't feel right, you know, doing that, because people know me and they think that I'm just downplaying it, and I'm not. It's really gone.
Is it water quality, overfishing?
It's overfishing a lot. It was many years, there weren't many people at all doing it, if any. Now in certain parts of it, there's a lot of bait fishermen out there. And as soon as that started, it really started dropping off. And, you know, now you can go and you may see 8 or 10 different boats out there in one day in 2 miles of river. And it's not fun anymore. And, you know, I don't feel right taking people out doing it.
Do you remember the first time that you noticed that it was starting to become congested?
Yes, it was about 5.5, 6 years ago. You know, I saw like 2 boats in one day, which to me, that was a traffic jam. I'm not used to seeing anybody down there. And, you know, it was a few more, and then people that I knew on the river would call me and tell me, I saw so-and-so in a boat, or I saw 3 boats today. And, you know, I had it for over 20 years, or close to 20 years, more than that, for a long time. And, you know, I had it to myself. And, you know, I feel pretty lucky that I did. We've had some wonderful fishing days out there and wonderful guide trips. I made a lot of friends and, you know, repeat customers constantly. And, you know, it was great. And, you know, as with most good things, it's done.
So what's the deal with bait fishing? Is it that, and before we go there, I should probably ask you some more questions about stripers, because admittedly, I've never caught one. And the first one I ever really saw, I was actually in Atlanta and was teaching on, what's the big river? The Chattahoochee.
That's it.
And this beautiful, big, silver, dead, unfortunately, fish floated by me. And I was with Lewis Cahill. I know you know Lewis. And yes. He said, that's a striper. And I was just dumbfounded by it. I've never seen one like that before. There, it was way bigger than I thought that it was going to be, or that they were going to be. So I really don't know that much about them. Are they an anadromous fish? Are they what's the biology behind stripers?
Originally, they are anadromous. The first place they got trapped in South Carolina behind Santee Cooper dams when they, the lake system just north of Charleston. I think it was in the 40s when they built those dams, and, you know, people started seeing stripers a few years later, and, you know, they weren't stocking them in there. They just got trapped in there, and there was enough river above those lakes to where they could, you know, have a successful spawn. And, you know, when they figured that out, all the states around in the Southeast started, you know, stocking them, you know, in their lakes. And we have a lake here it's a little over 70 miles south of here on the Chattahoochee. And, you know, the lake was built in the early 70s, mid 70s. And, you know, they stocked it with stripers. And probably 10 years there, they didn't stock any. They went to nothing but hybrids, which is a cross between a white bass and striper. But there were still stripers in the river. And, you know, we started catching some. And for many years, everything you caught was 20 pounds plus. Good fish. And, you know, I don't know how, you know, it kept going, because we weren't seeing any small fish, but they were all big fish. And it went on for over 10 years. And then they started stocking them in West Point again. And then we started getting a lot of fish. And, you know, I've caught them, you know, 35 pounds is the biggest. And, yeah, that's pretty good fish.
That's
and
enormous.
And one of my customers caught it. I didn't. I caught – my personal is like 30. Oh. But it was a great fishery.
Are they just eating, you know, all the little ones? Why only big fish?
I don't know. They weren't stocking any, you know, down in the lake. But I think that had to have some spawning going on. And, you know, finally we started seeing some fish in the 5 to 8 pound range that, you know, it was like 1 year they must have had a good spawn and it was successful. So, you know, you give a fish half a chance and they'll be successful. Some of them will. Nature's always going to find a way unless we mess it up.
But they do have the ability to spawn. It's not like they're like triploids or something where they can't spawn.
No. They can spawn. And in the state of Georgia, we have two subspecies. We have an Atlantic species, which they stock in all the rivers and lakes that go into the Atlantic. Then we have an Apalachicola species that goes to the Gulf, and it's the only strain that goes to the Gulf. You know, because the Chattahoochee River used to run straight down through there, but they're trying to get the genetics right, at least anyhow. So,
and then what is their personality when it comes to fishing for them? What are they like? Are they shy? Are they aggressive? Because in my head, they're this predatory species where I'd be quite, you know, it'd be an aggressive strip back. Am I thinking about this right?
Yeah. It's kind of a strange deal. Everybody thinks of stripers as low light conditions, you know, late afternoon, early morning, cloudy days. But on the Chattahoochee, it's been more successful on bright sunny days and, you know, beating the banks. So I'll get to where we can make a long cast into the bank and it needs to be within a foot or so of the bank and then get it coming back. And, if you can't hit the bank, you won't catch as many fish. So, you know, there were times I had to get people closer, but, you know, you really need to get it on the bank because those fish will be right there and they may follow it all the way back to the boat, or there may be fish in the middle of the river that you pick up, you know, that'll just come up. But, you know, there were times that if people did not strip all the way back to the boat, they go to pick up and you'd see one just fly out of nowhere trying to catch that fly and too late.
So is that why bait fishing could potentially be so dangerous? Because they just can't help themselves?
Oh, they can't help themselves. I learned this fishery. I've fished in every kind of way possible. I always have. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll use other techniques as a tool to learn something. And that's pretty much how I learned the striper fishery was, you know, with bait and conventional tackle. There was always a fly rod in the boat. But, you know, if things were tough and I was trying to figure out where they were living or what they were doing, you know, I used to break that out and figure it out. Yeah. And then I could go home, tie some different flies or get different lines and go try it out. And, you know, it worked. And I can promise you bait, if you know how to use bait, it's very, very dangerous to a population of stripers.
What kind of bait? Are you pulling plugs or like cut plugs? What are you doing? I know so you're talking to a salmon and steelhead gal. So when I fish bait, I used, you know, roe or something. I used to use like squid legs that I dye pink so they look like little worms. What are you using for stripers? Because I'm assuming they're not taking a big roe bag.
No, but they probably would.
Oh, okay.
They would. The best thing that you could use was cut herring.
Okay. So you cut your
And we have blueback herring here. But most people, it's illegal to use that on the Chattahoochee, but in the lakes you can. We have shad and, you know, a couple other kinds of shad. And then, you know, people will use just regular cut bait, brim, you know, bluegill, cut up, anything. But the herring is just like candy to them. They love it.
So when did the bait ban come into place?
There's not a ban.
Do you think there should be?
Oh, yeah.
Do you find that you get stuck in some sort of controversy there? Because I was watching you on DOS Boat, and I believe an angler should be able to fish everything, or at least know how to fish everything. And I saw you using soft plastics, which just immediately gave you a tick in my book because I'm a huge soft plastic fan. And I saw you with bait and with the fly rod, and I thought, that's a fisherman. And it's tough, though, because I know for me, I get criticized when I fish anything else because most people know me as a fly fisher. And it's like, well, that's not really fair. What about you? Do you find that you get pigeonholed or stuck in a corner with some people?
No. Our rule of thumb at the store is rule number one is when you go saltwater fishing, you know, or off on a trip, always carry a spinning rod or a casting rod with you. Always, you know, you never know. I went down to Brazil at the first of the year, January 1st this year, and I'm still kicking myself for not taking a casting rod because the water came up about 10 to 12 feet the week before I got there, and I really needed a casting rod. So no, and most of our customers think it's the greatest thing they've ever heard is that, you know, you should have a spinning rod. There's times the fly rod just will not work. And if you're off on a trip, you want to catch fish. So, you know, it's not a bad thing to have it. I do have customers that will not do anything but fly fish. It's you know, you're going to have that too. And, you know, if they want to hate on me, they can. But, you know, I like to do it all. And, you know, if you need to, you need to.
Yep. No, I hear you. So what about this whole pressure thing? How many people, if you see 10 boats and that's too many boats or too many people, I mean, to me, that doesn't sound like anything crazy, right? I think the Bulkley where I live, 10 boats, all right, totally manageable. I think about Montana. Why with stripers on that section of the river is 10 boats too many? Genuine question.
I think that a lot of the fish get killed, you know, by mishandling, by, you know, with social media, everybody needs 47 pictures for every fish. And, you know, one day I was out there and this fish came by me, about a 12-pound striper, and it was floating. And I knew there was a guy that was about a quarter of a mile up there, and I could hear him, and I knew his boat. And you know, here comes that fish. And he has to take a lot of pictures for social media. He's just a big picture guy. And that I picked up the fish, and he was just had died. And I knew what that was. And you know, an hour later, I saw another one. And, you know, you see quite a few dead fish. You already mentioned that you saw one down on the river come floating by dead. And the people that are live bait fishing or cut bait fishing.
Wait, you can fish live bait there?
No, but they do.
Okay. Yeah.
But they can fish cut bait. And they get gut hooked a lot, and those fish, they're probably going to die. You know, everybody says, well, they'll be fine. You know, stick a hook down in your stomach and pull it through your stomach lining and see how long you live through that. So, yeah.
So what about the people listening right now who are screaming at their phone or their computer and they're going, nope, it's not pressure, it's survival somewhere. So these fish aren't in the ocean. So we've already, or they are in the ocean. Is it? No.
No, they're not. They're in the lakes. We have, I think there's six or seven dams between here and the Gulf.
Okay. So it's not ocean survival. So what else could it honestly be? Can they net the river mouth?
No.
Oh.
No, it runs into a lake down there, but there's probably 50 guides down there on the lake. And right now, believe it or not, the limit on stripers under 21 inches is 20 fish.
Wait, what do you can retain 20 fish under 21 inches?
Right.
But I don't understand. Why is that? Unless they're trying to get rid of an entire species.
That's the problem is, you know, the white bass, the hybrid bass, and the stripers, you know, that are all under 21 inches, they look similar. And anybody, you know, I can look at them and see a big difference between any of them. But, you know, people were complaining about getting tickets for having over the limit. So what they did was everything under 21 inches is 20 fish. Over 21 inches is two.
Confusing if they're trying to bring them back. How can you tell the difference between a white? Because I have caught white bass. How can you tell the difference between the two?
The body shape is very different. They're a little bit thicker through the middle.
Yeah, I feel like the white bass I caught compared to the dead striper I saw, the striper seemed more streamlined.
Right, longer, mm-hmm. skinny.
Yeah.
And the white bass is a little more thicker throughout the middle of the body. Yeah, and the hybrid is as well. You know, the hybrid does get bigger than the white bass, but the hybrid will have broken lines and the white bass will have straight lines. And, you know, the stripers generally have straight lines, but not always.
Coming up, Rob and I continue our conversation. Before I move on to, because I want to talk to you about muskie, is there anything, I feel irresponsible walking away from a conservation focus to just talk about fishing for a different species. Is there anything in particular that we need to talk about about stripers before I move to the next topic? Anything that anyone needs to know who's listening in the area?
Well, we have some recently new appointed people on the DNR board, and I'm going to really bend some ears this summer when the fish get up this far, and I'm going to take a couple of them fishing and hopefully I can, you know, we can have a halfway decent day where we catch a few and just kind of explain to them and maybe we can get some changes here. You know, I just want to get rid of the bait. I'm not going to go as far as to try to take away all artificial fishing, whether it's fly or conventional, but I want the bait gone. And, you know, it's a very unique fishery. And, you know, we're in a big city. I can't remember how many millions of people we have here, but it's a big city. And we had an awesome, great fishery for many, many years that is gone. And that part of the river at one time when I first started fishing was a great trout stream. And with all the growth here, the water temperature started rising. And by the mid-90s, it was just too high to support the trout on that lower section of the river. And so now there's no trout in there. And it was incredible. If we just had time to talk about that, that could be a whole show. It was crazy good.
Yeah. Well, have all the time in the world. I mean, I don't know what it's late for you, but it's funny because I've only fished in Georgia twice. No, I've been to Georgia a few times. I fished once and I was on the Chattahoochee a second time, but not really fishing. I was teaching. The fishery that I was experiencing in Georgia was a small stream, like a little trout creek.
Right.
And it was one of the most unique fisheries. I have fished quite a few days in Georgia. I can't remember where else I was. It was a larger river, but it's so wild. And it's not at all what I expected, because I think of Atlanta as being this really big place, but just a few hours out of Atlanta, there's incredibly quiet, tranquil streams full of fish. Is that the sort of stream that you're talking about when you talk about trout, or are we talking specifically right now trout on the lower stretch of the river?
On the Chattahoochee.
Wow.
On the lower stretch.
So how were they brought in there? Did they get put in there years ago?
Yeah, it was, there were some guys that got into the hatchery a little bit back in the 60s, and they may or may not have been working for the DNR at the time. It's kind of a secret.
Okay. I couldn't tell if your may or may not was a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But
right.
Gotcha.
It is.
Okay.
And that's how it got started, up below the Lake Lanier Dam. And, you know, they survived. They did well. And they're still doing well. As they don't even stock browns in there. They haven't stocked them in 10 or 11 years now. And they're doing great. There's not enough food in the river to grow a lot of big fish. And, you know, years when we have a shad kill in the lake, you'll see some bigger fish because they'll eat everything that comes through. And they'll, you know, they'll grow. But if they get big enough to where they can eat hatchery fish, then they've made it. They can really start growing big then. But that's what it takes, because it's not a rich river. They've cleaned it up too much.
What do you mean?
Too much. The entire three counties that it came out of was very rural until just recently. And, you know, there were farms, you know, cows and horses, chickens and all that, and everything washed downstream, which supported the bug life. And then once all that went, and now it's all subdivisions and houses, and the bug life went with it. And so now there's just not enough food in there to support the fish and grow big fish.
Do the stripers and trout compete?
There's a dam in between them.
Oh.
So there's a small dam that was, it's probably 80 or 90 years old now, and that's in between. So they keep them separated.
Gotcha. What's native to that river?
Shoal bass, largemouth bass, and you know, catfish, all your warm water species.
Right. Ooh, I love catfishing. Is there conflict there? I know that I know certain people who would be screaming that all the trout and the stripers should be wiped out and just let the river get back to what it used to be. What are your thoughts on that?
The stripers originally, before we built all the dams on the river, there were stripers in this river. All right. So there was the Gulf strain of stripers that were in this river. So, you know, they have a right to be there. The shoal bass, you know, were always there. And the problem with shoal bass now is the water temps are too cold for good production until you get further south. You know, it used to be cold enough for trout. Now it's not. But it's too cold for the shoal bass. The Flint River, which is one of the main tributaries on the Chattahoochee that, you know, runs down south, its fishery is, there's not a dam on that river. And so they have great shoal bass fishing. And we have so-so shoal bass fishing because the water's too cold.
I'm trying to envision a map of where the water's going. Where does that water end up flowing down to?
Flows from here southwest to the Alabama state line. And then it makes the state line all the way down to where Alabama and Florida and Georgia all come together. And that's the Apalachicola. And then it just flows right into the Gulf down there.
When I think of Georgia, I think of it getting busier. And but when I think of Alabama, I think I still think of it being kind of low, well, not low key, but not as busy as Georgia. Is that, inaccurate? Yeah. I mean, I lived in Arkansas for a year, so I'm trying to remember what it was like down in the South when I did used to spend some time over there.
It's not quite like Arkansas anymore, but you
know. Why, so it's Arkansas still technically like, do you still think of that as the bush? So yeah. I love that. I think if I was going to live somewhere, there's lots of places I'd like to live, obviously on the coast, but I liked being in Arkansas. I liked being out there feeling like I was in the bush. Can you still feel like you're in the bush the more south you go from Atlanta?
I can take you places inside the city limits on the river and you'll feel like you're in the bush, you know, and that was a great thing. And you can come around a bend and look up and see a skyscraper. You know, and, you know, which I don't much really like to see, but, you know, they're there and people think that's pretty cool that, you know, you're way out in the middle of the country here. And then yet you round a bend and there's Six Flags. You know, we go right by Six Flags sometimes. So.
See, I hate that stuff. I like to pretend like I'm from hundreds of years ago.
Exactly.
But okay. So tell me about you then personally, because I kind of get that vibe from you as well. Do you feel, this is going to come across as really rude, but I'm not great with the whole filter thing. Do you ever feel like you've not sold yourself out, but do you feel stuck being somewhere so busy because you need to pay bills? If you had it your way and you never had to pay a bill for the rest of your life, would you just disappear or would you still be near Atlanta?
No, I would be out of Georgia. When I was young, up until the mid 80s, I thought Georgia was the greatest state in the union. I really thought it was great. It had everything I wanted. It had great fishing. I don't hunt big game. I hunt birds, quail and, you know, stuff like that, grouse. And we had really good hunting back then. Now you can't find a quail in the state. And it just, they're become kind of rare. The fishing is not what it was when, you know, 30, 40 years ago, even close. And right now, if I could cash out and go, I'm going to be somewhere in probably Southwest Idaho, Oregon, Washington State, in that triangle right in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? What about that appeals to you? Is it the ocean? Is it the fish? Like, there's a million things. No, what still, is it about that?
Still 8 or 9 hours away from the ocean, but I love that country. I love the PNW. It is, you know, we did our honeymoon out there about 12 years ago, and I just, you know, I never wanted to leave. I just would love to stay there. But it has everything that I want. It has, you know, a lot of quail hunting, a lot of bird hunting, and it has good fishing, and it's all natural, mostly. You know, you can go out and not see anybody if you want to work hard enough for it and just get away. You know, I'm not seeing big cities. I cannot stand cities anymore. I cannot stand them. But, you know, it's I wish I was there now.
So what's stopping you? Because you could get a job anywhere. There's ways to live off the grid. There's ways to make money online. There's a million ways to do it. You're still young enough that you can get out. You know, you're not in your 80s or anything like that. Not in your 70s. You're still early 60s, you said, yeah?
Yeah.
62?
62.
I mean, my husband's 50. So for me, 50, 60, it's all the same. It's all pretty young. You can get out and go. What's stopping you?
I can do more than most 50-year-olds can.
Yeah, so. Right? So why not just get up and go? And I'm sorry, Fishhawk, if you're listening. I'm not trying to poach him, but.
No, that's cool. You know, my wife, she's just not ready. You know, she's real concerned about being prepared for being retired. And we're close, just not quite there yet. And that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, you know, that's fair.
Yeah.
Did you ever
I would
have
be
kids?
Gone tomorrow.
Yeah, I hear you. Did you have kids?
No.
You guys don't have kids?
No kids.
I give you 3 years and you're out of here. I'm going to go ahead and set the timer. There's so many ways you can play with money and do things and plan and budget. And with automations nowadays, with finances, there's so many things you could do. I give you 3 to 5 years and you're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
I won't get you in trouble here with your wife or your work, but I will segue into Muskie. So I see that you've got this real fascination with Muskie. Where did that all come from?
I don't know. I like catching weird things. I like fishing for different fish. You know, it's just anything off the wall through town here. We have a major waterway through town. It's not the Chattahoochee River, but it's called Peachtree Creek. And when I was a kid, it was the cesspool, you know, of Atlanta. Everything ran into it, and, you know, it was as polluted as could be. Now it has fish in there. And, you know, they're just little, you know, sunfish, brim, four or five different species of brim, occasionally some bass. In the wintertime, when we had the delayed harvest on the Chattahoochee, the trout would swim down river and then come up Peachtree Creek, and we'd have trout in the middle of town.
Right.
You know, under these expressways and all that, and nobody knew it. And, you know, nobody knew it.
Are you allowed to talk about this here? Should everyone take their headphones out right now?
No, we're good.
Okay.
We're good. They didn't have the delayed harvest this year, so there's no trout in there. But, you know, it was just the weird places, the weird fish. And some time ago, I found out that there were muskie in Tennessee, or the closest ones. And that's 3 hours from here. And so I started fishing for those. And, you know, it's been a challenge, you know, learning about muskie and, you know, see fish and, you know, just have follows. And so that was extremely challenging to catch something that, you know, the fish of 10,000 casts. And I know I'm way over 10,000 just in Tennessee, you know. And then 3 years ago, I had a chance to go up to Virginia and fish with a master. And Blaine Chopper.
Blaine, yeah. He's great.
Yeah. Oh, he's my hero. He is. And we hit it off, and now we're friends. And it's one of the greatest things ever. And, you know, I never would have had this without being in the industry. And, you know, I went with him last year. And the first day, and I'm fishing out of the back of the boat because my buddy has yet to catch a fish. And about 30 minutes into it, I catch one in the mid-40s, you know, and, you know, pretty happy about that. But it was too early in the trip to catch a fish. And, you know,
because then you had to sit out the rest of it.
Well, no, I was still fishing, but, you know, you catch one too soon. It's like catching one on the first cast, you know, mm-hmm. And with muskies, you know, an hour is the first cast. So I caught that. And then, you know, we fished all the rest of that day. And the next day it was raining and snowing all day long. And we could not figure out what was going on. And Blaine and I were talking. And, you know, he made a little cast and got hooked up, and I watched him. I made him cast. He didn't ask to. I made him cast, and I watched everything he did.
Yeah, well, know, do I, tell. I, what did he do?
He just did it right. You know, it wasn't much different than what I'd been doing all day, but he knew that particular spot better than I did. And I just could not get dialed in on it.
Did he have to get down? Because as soon as I hear snow, I just think, oh, you got to get down, different angles, different flies. What did he do? Did he cast farther upstream? Like, what were the subtleties that he did?
He let it sink for about a second and a half longer than I did, and he got it right into the hull. So my very next cast, the results were on the picture of Fly Fisherman magazine.
Okay, huge. That's awesome. So that was that same day.
Yeah, last cast of the day. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's the way to do it. So yeah. What kind of lines are you using when you're fishing for muskie on a cold day?
It's we're using SA lines and some heavily weighted, like the Sink 30 clear type lines, which are not great in cold weather, but, you know, they're coming out with some new lines that I'm probably not allowed to talk about. You know,
that's all
Blaine
right.
has some coming, but, you know, looking forward to that. That are, you know, developed for more cold weather, but kind of have the same taper so that you can throw these big flies. I mean, the fly was 12 inches, a game changer, 12 inches.
Do you feel like clear intermediate lines are just, I don't know. I was talking about this with Marty Shepard the other day. We both feel like clear intermediate lines or even clear sink, any clear lines are being, they're underrated, right? A lot of people have kind of forgotten about them. Because I remember when I first started fly fishing, and it wasn't as long as you, but it was still, well, so over 20 years ago. And that was the thing. Like, you wanted to have clear lines for coho. And I just assumed that they would only become more popular, but they seem to have dropped off.
I don't know why they've dropped off. It's I use it for almost every species I fish for. And, I used it down in Bolivia in October, used it in Brazil, use it here and, you know, musky fish and everything. I'm not going anywhere without a clear intermediate line. It's just
maybe
my
it's just the Pacific Northwest.
That's
because
probably
as soon as
it.
The lines got fatter, the lines got more condensed. Obviously, sink tips are all sorts of colors now, primarily gray if they're sinking. And I know that I've watched the clear tips slowly back away. And it wasn't until I came actually down here to Australia that I started to realize that, oh, people do still use these just in different situations than we do for salmon, steelhead, and trout.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use a clear line for trout?
For throwing streamers. You know, I went out streamer fishing last Thursday, hoping to catch with one of the young guides, like 21-year-olds. And, you know, we wanted a fish over 25 and we didn't come close, but, you know, I caught 13 browns and, all on a streamer. And mostly on the intermediate line. I started off, we had a little faster water, higher water, and, you know, was using a full sinking line. And then, you know, as the water dropped a little bit, I went to the intermediate.
Right. Gotcha. Speaking of water dropping, have you found that fish are more bitey when the water is coming up or when it's coming down?
I like it more when it's coming up.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Do tell. See, again, this is also species
specific.
To a point. Okay.
You know, when it gets too high, you know, then you, I think the fish will move and then you have to go find them. They'll move to the banks. If at least on our river here, I think that, you know, a lot of times I can do well when it's coming down until it gets dead down, and then, you know, you have less current and they'll turn all the way off on that.
Mm-hmm. Why do they do that? It's the same thing here in Australia with tidal systems. As soon as the current goes, everything seems, or, you know, changes. Feels like everything when it's slack stops
biting. It's not moving the bait. You start getting some current in there and the bait doesn't deal with the current as good as the big fish do. And so they'll get moving around and, you know, they're being forced to move. The fish turn on and start eating. And then, you know, when it goes through its cycle and comes back down, you know, they'll move on the, when it's moving. and then they'll stop when it gets down dead low.
I was fishing dead low the other day for Australian bass, and I noticed that when I'd strip my popper back through the bait that they would all jump, you know how they just spray. And I had always assumed that that would be the ideal ambush spot for a bass, is that, or any fish that's eating bait, is that they would find the school of bait that's not moving and then ambush them. But is that wrong? Are they more likely to target them when they're moving with the current, like you said?
I think, you know, you won't see as much action when there's not much current. And then, you know, when the current starts and the bait fish start really moving a lot, you know, you'll see the bigger fish turn on.
Right. Do you have any advice for somebody? I'm totally asking for selfish reasons now, because this was just 5 days ago and I'm remembering the situation. I was fishing under a dam and the tide was on, it was a slack tide. Mm-hmm. And within 5 minutes of being there, there's just this crazy activity, and there were a number of bass in there, and there was just bait and boils everywhere. It was honestly a little bit overwhelming. Is that something that would happen to you down where you are? And if so, how do you manage it from a fishing stance?
The toughest days were when they started changing the generation schedule and or how much water they were putting out. If it was a really low flow, like 800 CFS versus 1,000, which, you know, 1,000 is kind of the low flow, but sometimes it would drop down to 800. At 800, it was really hard to catch fish. You know, 1,000 to 1,100, it'd be on. And, you know, as if it was up to about 2,500, you know, it's pretty good. And then it'll drop off on that, because usually the water picks up too much dirt and gets muddy.
Yeah. Can the fishing become good when it's like that?
If you change tactics, put the fly rod down and get conventional out, not bait, but just conventional with big plugs that make a lot of noise. Yes, it can get good.
Right, right. Fair enough. Have you seen those artificial, or what are they called? They're animated lures.
Probably.
There are these, I think it's pretty new, and you plug them in. I don't know if this is considered cheating. I think it's experimental. So I bought a couple of these animated lures and I charged them. And then when you put them in the water triggers something and they're robotic. So they move.
Oh yeah. That's something my grandfather would have bought all of them.
Right. Have you tried one yet? We weren't able to use them, to be fair. The fishing was good. We didn't have to. And I didn't want to lose them because they ended up costing like $100 each and they took forever to get there. Oh, they're a fortune. I don't recommend buying them unless you know somebody, because I paid full price. I thought it was a scam. It took like 3 months for them to get there. Two lures ended up costing me like $287 Canadian dollars, something ridiculous. But they're really, really funky, and I'm excited to give them a go. But I didn't know if you'd seen them or if the Fishhawk sells them.
No, I haven't seen them. Usually you see that stuff in ads somewhere,
I'd seen it in an ad. I totally bought into it.
Yeah, I'm not on places where I'll see that many ads very often. So
I think someone said to me on TikTok, I will send you a link because I think that it's worth just knowing that they exist.
Surprised my wife hasn't shown me then, because she's the TikTok lady.
So. I'll send you a link. Okay, I've got a few more questions for you and then I'll start to wrap it up because I know it's getting late there. Bucket list species. If there was something that you could catch tomorrow that you haven't yet, what would it be?
Well, that's interesting because my bucket list trip was to Bolivia, and that's one that I really wanted to do for many, many, many years. And I went back in October, and I saw all your videos and all that stuff.
Are you with Marcelo?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's just a trip of a lifetime.
I wasn't with Marcelo, but I was at Pluma, and Chucky, yep, and that whole crew, they all knew you, you know.
What did you think of the trip?
That was the best trip I've ever been on. And I tell everybody now that that's right back to the top of my bucket list, you know, because it's just something that, you know, I didn't want to leave and I just still want to go back. It's still still like as if I've never done it. I still want to go back. And it was more fun. And, you know, it's the greatest place.
That's except so those, funny. I give the same answer when people wait, except for those what fascinated by what you're going to say.
The little sand flies.
Oh, see, we didn't have any of those, believe it or not.
Very last day, I made a mistake of wearing shorts to leave. Should not have done that. But that was the only time I got bitten.
Yeah, so. Right. So were you guys catching Dorado? And so which one did you prefer? Did you prefer the Dorado or the, what's it called?
Paku.
Yeah.
The first fish I caught was a Paku.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I only saw three others the entire trip and, you know, wasn't able to do anything with them. But the Dorado, it was like every day it's bigger and bigger and bigger. And I'm like, how's it going to get bigger? Next cast, even bigger. You know, it was just the greatest thing ever. And, you know, they attack with reckless abandon. They'll be in 3 inches of water, a 20-pound fish in 3 inches of water, you know. And, you know, we had a big rain and the river got muddy and everybody was very worried. And I'm like, no, these fish live here. They have to eat. You know, they're just going to move shallower. And fishing was great. You know, even muddy, and it was great.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just, I loved it. I've never experienced that before, and I've loved it.
And the culture, the bit of danger out in the jungle, it's my favorite trip I've ever taken. Were you able to eat a paku?
No.
I don't know if they still do that, but we kept ours because we were on a camping trip and we just needed some good food or some fresh food. It is hands down the best fish I've ever had. Not just because I was starving. It's real fatty. And the ribs, it's got these crazy ribs that are like pork ribs. So you eat them. You know how you eat barbecue ribs? You eat them like ribs. Oh, ridiculous. So good. So what's next for you, Rob? I feel like you're just entering the next stage of your life.
I don't know. I'm the store that I work at, the Fish Hawk, recently sold. So we have new owners. And, you know, I've known both of them for many years. I've fished with both of them for many years. One of them is very young and he was on the U.S. youth fly fishing team. So he has a Euro nymphing history. He doesn't like to claim it. He's one of the best casters that I've ever seen. He's very good on everything. You know, and the other one has, you know, just loves fishing, has been a customer for a long time. And we've all been, or the two, he and I have been friends for many, many years. We were both in Gray's Journal together about 8 or 9 years ago. And, you know, so he's an owner, you know, so I'm looking forward to this and being a big part of that, at least for a few more years, until I can move out west.
Like I said, 3 years. Yeah. what about the mustache? When's that coming back? I loved it. I thought it looked great on you.
It's usually gone by now, the beard. It's usually gone. When it gets warm here, I'd usually get rid of it. And it's always been seasonal. The mustache will stay. It's always been there, but the beard will go.
Can I throw a couple rapid questions at you and then we'll wrap it up?
Certainly.
Okay. Craziest thing you've ever seen on your home water?
Wow. I don't know. There's been anything super crazy other than, you know, rescuing some people here and there, you know.
A lady
and her son turned over a kayak and got pinned. And I think it's a very good thing that we were very close to them. Because at that time, there was nobody else on the water, and it could have been hours before they got out.
Yeah, not everyone can say that.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a jaguar down there? Do they have jaguars down there?
Here? In Georgia?
Panthers. Is it panthers? Which are the ones that are in?
They claim that we don't, but we do. Mainly in South Georgia, because there's a fair amount of them in Florida. So they wander up into South Georgia. Some of them will wander around, you know, town and make it to North Georgia. You know, I've seen them on people's trail cams. But the state will tell you no. But there's some here, not a lot. You know, it would be very rare. We have a lot of bears, but you know, the panthers is going to be more South Georgia, Florida.
Gotcha. What are your thoughts on tube flies?
I'm playing with those now for shad. So you know, little ones, and it's pretty cool. This is a new experience for me. You know, I've tried to play with it some, but one of our employees is part-time, you know, is retired from Smith Optics.
Oh, cool.
And he worked for him for 29 years. He kind of ran the Southeast. And so he and I went out last year. I finally, after all summer, got a new motor after mine blew up in the spring. Took like 6 months to get it. So I took him out there and I told him, I said, we're going to be doing a lot of riding at slow speeds. I said, when we get to places, we'll stop and fish. And so he brought a couple spay rods and he thought it was the greatest thing ever watching me fail or flail, either one. And, he just thought that was great. So now my goal is to get good at it. So
you will just slow it down. If in doubt, just slow it down.
It's hard to do. It's hard to slow down.
I know. What are your thoughts on UV tying materials?
I think there's days where it will definitely make a difference. And I think it's more so on the sunny days. You know, it's like flash, whether it's UV or not. You know, flash usually works much better for me on a sunny day than it does on a cloudy day. And, you know, I think it's going to be the same thing with the UV. You know, it's hard for us to really see the difference in a lot of that stuff, but, you know, we'll see.
Cool. I'll wrap it up. And then I guess my last question I just want to know so I can spread the word is, are you ever planning on hosting trips?
Yeah, I'm doing one to Brazil.
Good. When?
In November, I think. October or November. I had one booked for the COVID year, number one. And so that all got canceled. And so they're opening back up. So I'm going to start in doing that to Brazil. And then the Fishhawk has not had hosted trips in like 15 years, and we're going to bring it back. So, mm-hmm. You know, I'll be hosting quite a few trips after that.
I could see that being such a good fit. Yeah. Have you ever been steelheading? Do you have any interest in going steelhead fishing or salmon fishing?
I have a great interest for it. I've done it. If you want to, you can't call them steelhead. Great Lakes, rainbows. Well.
Yeah. Those Michigan fish, they fight like steelhead, those Michigan fish.
They look like
not,
them.
Not all the states do, but.
No, but I've caught some one in Wisconsin mm-hmm. and mainly in New York. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's
on the Pacific. You haven't been out in grizzly country in the wild, wild west yet?
I've fished the Deschutes several times, but I haven't done it at the right time. And, you know, I'm really excited about it. I have all the equipment. I don't have the ability quite yet, but yeah, I will.
Cool. I think now if people want to reach you, because I know that you're not really a social media guy, but I know that there are going to be people who want to come fishing with you. How can they get a hold of you to do that?
Either call me at the Fish Hawk or Atlanta Mustache on Instagram.
Yeah, perfect. I'll link that up too so that they can find you that way as well. Okay, cool. Before we wrap it up, is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
No, I think this was great.
Thank you for coming on. I hear that all the time, but I never know why. I guess if you don't do a lot of podcasts, you don't know what to expect, right?
Yeah. You know, I kind of did one, and it was with a close friend, and, you know, they were a bunch of pranksters, so that's all that was.
Was there a lot of beer drinking?
No, I'm sure there was plenty on the other side that day.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. Well, look, honestly, I think you're just an absolute gentleman. I was really genuinely looking forward to getting to hear more about your story, so thank you for sharing it.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been great. It's a great honor. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Don't be a stranger. Stay in touch. I'd love to fish with you someday. So if you come out west,
you come here.
Yeah. Well, I actually do have to get out that way in the next year. But you, if you can ever get down to Australia, there's this fish called a Murray cod.
Yeah, I know. I've seen them. I've seen pictures of them.
I think you'd be all about it. And I think you'd be a real stick out here.
Cool.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Well, don't be a stranger. Stay in touch, right. And I'll let you know when this is live and going.
Thank you, April.
Thanks,
Rob.
I really appreciate it.
All right.
Likewise. Bye. Right. And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.